Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And I'm going to cover the rest of the obligatories. I totally forgot. So before I get into everything else, let's wrap up this article that I've been covering, an act to regulate the deposits of the public money, because I'm just almost done with this and about ready to dive into the Martin Van Buren article that will be following behind this. And that will be, let me see here, the title of this article by Martin Van Buren, it's actually a message to the nation. The Act of the 23rd of June, 1836, regulating the deposits of the public money. So we're going to actually expose how Martin Van Buren had helped try pushing this. Well, not helped try. He pushed this. They successfully pushed these things. And nobody was questioning what the heck was going on. Now, I do know for a fact that in 1821, after Monroe had done the things that he had done with the public lands, the two things that happened in 1820 that were just, eye-popping, to where there was this desire to get Madison to actually give or provide a copy of his notes on the Constitutional Convention. This was in 1821. After, because news doesn't necessarily travel fast. And as a matter of fact, unless you're living in D.C., you're not really catching what's going on in D.C. It's kind of like things happening and you go, what just happened? Now, we live in a day of instant, communications, where if they want you to know about it, they'll put it out there. And you'll hear about it immediately, even maybe sometimes before something happens, because that means that it's completely orchestrated. But we live in a time of real-time information. In those days, it took time for people to understand what just happened in this act, that Congress did this other state, unless you were involved in that state or you were involved in the principal principal people, those people that were directly involved in Missouri becoming a state, those people that were directly involved in the process of creating this compromise, the Missouri Compromise, unless you were directly involved in the establishment of the Public Lands Act of 1820, lots of these things were just kind of, nobody was questioning this. So I believe that by the time people started realizing, they go, then they started discussing this, going, how does this align with the Constitution? So I don't have the letter, and I might be able to find it, and I probably should, but I do have Madison's response to John G. Jackson. And this letter to John G. Jackson was in 1821. Now, John G. Jackson may have sent the letter much earlier. Who knows? I don't think Madison's that tardy in responding. But nevertheless, I think it was finally, these men finally concluded, the only way we're going to really know what's constitutional now is we need to read those notes on the Constitutional Convention, because that's something they didn't have. And so they asked him, hey, would you please release these notes? They being John G. Jackson, for a collective group of people. Now, John G. Jackson knew James Madison. They were kind of family associates. Don't know the level or the degree of how chummy they were. But nevertheless, you can tell in Madison's final comments, give our regards to the missus type of thing. More of a personal note. But the fact is that when Madison responded, there were some very interesting things he talked about. He already talked about the plan that was already devised before the Constitutional Convention in undermining the ratification of the Constitution, as well as derailing, you know, the direction of the Constitution. So this is why we covered this one letter. I usually don't get into those things, but it provides insights that Madison was well aware of the treasurer, or I should say the secretary for the convention, definitely allowed his biases to guide his pen in how he accounted for the facts. Madison was pretty much just trying to capture things. You can tell in his notes, you can kind of see his biases. He glosses over him, and you can kind of see some of the things that, you know, he was alluding to that kind of portrayed a bias. Not kind of. I called him out when we went through it. But that being said, Madison asserted that when it comes to understanding the Constitution, it doesn't matter what I thought. The father of the Constitution tells his friend and company, it doesn't matter what I thought. It doesn't matter what the convention thought. The only thing that matters is how the states understood the Constitution at its time of ratification. In other words, how the Constitution was sold to the states, period. That's it. Okay, so getting into these artifacts, these acts, these aren't even artifacts. These are truly official documents that actually highlight government violations. These acts were definitely outside the bounds of the powers of those delegated objects within the Constitution. So therefore, that's why we're covering these things. This is really critical stuff. But before I get into Van Buren's comments, I want to drill into the Constitution and impeachments. So let me kind of wrap up Madison's acts. I'll get into the obligatories, as I said, and then we will dive further into the, you know, these acts of, you know, perniciousness and so forth, of how they were deliberately violated the Constitution. So, Friday, I covered Section 4 and 5. I started going into Section 6, and I said, you know, I don't have enough time. So let me back up onto Section 5. And this is, I'm highlighting some of this stuff. And it is further enacted that no bank shall be selected or continued as a place of deposit of the public money, which shall not redeem its notes on bills on demand in specie. Do you know what that means? What that means is they have to be able to convert those bills and those, you know, I'll just say notes, whatever that paper currency was, it was required to be able to convert it into gold, silver, copper, nickel, whatever coins they had come up with as far as precious metals. I want to point this out. Now, why is that? Why is it that they want to maintain this? They're creating this system because one of the things we know is the undermining of a country is by creating banks and so forth, by doing these things. Now, what Jackson was doing, and I don't think Jackson was the mastermind behind this bank, behind this reestablishment, or actually creating a national bank without a charter, instead of making it kind of a separate entity, you know, an independent, or not independent, basically a subject, like a subcontract in contracting this very particular entity. So what they did instead was they actually created a national bank within the government, as the treasury being the principal. And so I'm trying to figure out why they wanted to make sure that the banks had to have gold. Now, one of the things, and I made this comment on Friday, that when you really look at what they were doing, they were putting a lot of American wealth on the line out there. And if you knew when that money and when that gold was going to be transferred, and you know, the route and everything else, you could actually be very, very vulnerable. You could actually set it up so that you could go capture that for yourself. They didn't have bulletproof, you know, movement of these types of things. And it was it was literally, that's why we see these great bank robberies. We see these great heists and so forth. And this is why I think they wanted to create the vulnerability, but I'm not sure. And I don't know if it really matters at this point. What really matters is the fact that they were actually creating a bank and actually, through legislation, subjugating state banks to be controlled by the federal government. So there was these two huge problems, constitutional problems. One, they couldn't operate a bank like that. They weren't supposed to have excessive money. They should have been reducing their taxes so that the burden on the states would be reduced. That's what they promised them. They promised them that we're only going to tax for what we need, for the necessary things we do. Oh, well, since everybody can live with this, you've gotten used to this taxation for the past 15, 20 years. That's about 15, 20 years. So now that we've got the surplus, by 1836, they had a significant surplus. Now, we counted the states, and I'm telling you, folks, $100 million is a lot of money. Now, I don't know where the numbers really fall, because I think they talked in these documents about $30 million being actually utilized to do this. But if they're actually putting a minimum of $5 million into each of these banks, that there needs to be one for each territory and state, and I count out all the states, I go, that's over $100 million. But anyway, the fact is, so that they're creating this banking system that, one, they don't have the authority to do, and they don't have the power to subjugate the state banks. And the states let this happen. Why did they let it happen? Because there was millions of dollars coming into them. Wow, that was going to give them an opportunity to, you know, have commerce or grow. And actually, the politicians were rubbing their grubby mitts, because they were going to figure out how this would empower them and how it would get them rich. So, this was the growth of corruption in the United States. Okay? This is where they really started corrupting the states. And, oh, by the way, isn't it ironic that at the exact same time this is happening and everybody's being bought up by the federal government, oh, the judiciary over here is just now implementing case law and precedents. Huh. That means that the judiciary is starting to wield the power of legislation. So are you going to speak up with your hand out, with these millions coming into your hand as a state, as a party to the compact, and you want this money? Well, you're going to shut up and not say anything about the other violations that are occurring at the same time, because you want the money. I can see how this elaborate growth was literally, it was orchestrated in such a sequence that, I mean, everybody just said, you know what? Yeah, that's not good, but yeah, I can live with that, because I'd rather have the money. This was the corrupting of America, period. As we started seeing things, and as they started creating these Ponzi schemes and other things, no doubt they were using money to corrupt the good state legislatures and good people of America. Anyway, so Section 6, this is where we kind of left off. And it be further enacted that the money which shall be in the Treasury of the United States on January 1837, reserving the sum of $5 million, shall be deposited with such of the several states in proportion to respective representation in the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States, as shall by law authorize the treasurers or their competent authorities to receive the same on the terms hereafter specified, which certificates shall express the usual and legal obligations, and pledge the faith of the state for the safekeeping and repayment thereof, and shall pledge the faith of the states receiving the same to pay the said monies and every part thereof from time to time, whenever the same shall be required, by the Secretary of the Treasury for the purpose of defraying any wants from the public treasury beyond the amount of the $5 million aforesaid. So in other words, they're basically throwing $5 million out to each of these states, provided that when said money or any part thereof shall be wanted by the said secretary to meet appropriations by law, the same shall be called for in ratable proportions within 1 year, as nearly as conveniently may be, from the different states with which the same is deposited, and shall not be called for in sums exceeding $10,000 from any one state in any one month, without previous notice of $30 or 30 days for every additional sum of $20,000, which may at any time be required. Section 7. And be it further enacted that the said deposits shall be made with the said states, in the following proportions and the following times, to wit, 1/4 part on January 1st, 1837, or as soon as thereafter may be, 1/4 part of the first day of April, 1/4 part of the first day of July, and 1/4 part of the first day of October, all in the same year. So they're going to basically deploy these $5 million in four different deposits. That it'll be $1.25 million, right? $1.25 million totaling $5 million going out to each of these states. Well, if they're really throwing out $5 million, then I believe when we read in Van Buren's comments, I think he says that the Treasury has $30 million. Somehow I remember, and I may be wrong, that they had this limit of $30 million. But if they actually throw out those kind of numbers to where we're looking at all of the states, again, we're looking at all of the states that are in the Union at that time. Shoot, when they did this on Friday, it was easily over $100 million. To me, and you got to remember that playing these types of games, they couldn't just do it with one, just like the Assumption Act. When they did the Assumption Act, they had to make sure everybody got their little stipend of money. Those who actually paid their debt had to get some kind of money that they would be actually equally corrupted. They would be equally obligated in playing in this system of the national bank and the national debt. So with that, let's wrap this one up. And let me go back into the obligatories, because that's what we need to do now. And so as we look and we start learning, and we continue to learn, I believe that everybody is starting to see, a little bit more of the big picture. It's about the total picture, the magnitude of the violations, the magnitude of what we need to do. Folks, I hear people all the time tell me that that's a lot of work. Actually, is it really? When you have a whole bunch of things going on around you, and none of them, maybe it's on your property, maybe it's in your business, but none of them are legitimate. When you challenge them and say, hold on here, you don't have any business being here. You don't have any right to be there. It's just that fast that goes away. Now, one of the things I warn, and I highly emphasize, what we want to do is we want to make sure that as we move forward, that we actually ensure that this is done methodically over a time schedule, so that everybody gets, if you've ever been fired, if you've ever been walked out of the job and, had no notice, that is just, that's the worst, right? So what we want to do is we want to make sure that those people who are really critical, they have the longest notice, and those people who are about to lose their job, they at least have a measure of time. Now, sometimes there are people that just get hostile. That's likely going to happen, especially when we look at those that may be in office. So they may be given just a severance for that period of time, and instead of it getting a lump sum, they will just be paid out by not coming to work. Because the last thing we want to do is we want people to have the people that are there working, knowing that they're leaving, and have access to do damage and to destroy things or what have you. So those people that, you know, can be pretty much believed, or not necessarily proven, but just it's the potential that they may be a bad player, then you just pay them for not coming to work, and that the payments will stop on a certain time, and by that point in time, they'll need to find a job elsewhere. Now, you got to remember that unemployment, that the way it has been managed by the Labor Department, all unconstitutional. These people won't have unemployment. They're not going to get that. Why? Because the federal government mandated that upon the states. Go look at unemployment benefits in your state constitution. It's not there. If it is, you happen to be one of the very few states that actually did it, because I haven't read every state constitution, but I've yet to find it. And so when these people go back to the states and say, I got fired, can you give me unemployment? That's going to be up to the people of the states and the legislature and so forth. Now, what we really want to do is we want to make sure that those people, maybe not the social engineers, but those people who actually, you know, were engaged in treasury accounting, you know, things that would translate out to the state jobs, they'll be able to move into these jobs, because the state government is going to increase slightly. Not exponentially, slightly. Because now the state is going to be doing things that the federal government never did. And oh, by the way, for the states to do these things, they will need to get the Constitution, the state Constitution, amended. Now, I'm hoping by this point in time that most of the states have already rewritten their constitutions so that when the time comes, these things will actually be brought into the county and the state already, brought into those accounts. So that when Department of Transportation, you know, shuts down, then those people will find jobs within the states and be able to, you know, kind of just transition from one job to another. The only thing that sucks is that their retirement, the thing that they were banking on, their retirement, that's not going to be there anymore. That's a liability that was unfortunately created because nobody did the due diligence. It's a travesty. So this goes down to, and this really, this can be solved in a humane way, but it is a problem that the states have to figure out. We cannot maintain government the way it is. We can't do this. But we can create some aid and comfort and those types of things. And more importantly, I believe that if we empower the people to do the right thing, because we're not taking all of their money from them anymore, that I believe that the people will start actually contributing to these private entities, their churches, to, you know, the local communities that are helping these types of things, these important things that we need to go through and resolve. So anyway, so when we come back, I'll finish the final obligatory, that we need to learn, pray, and act, and then we need to be focused on full compliance with the Constitution. Then I'm going to get into impeachment. The impeachment of former presidents, because I've talked about this before. We will be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so in the Constitution is this process called impeachment. We're going to cover that. But let me kind of wrap up, because I was talking about the taking over the states taking over those responsibilities that the federal government's been doing for them that they had no business to do, and how to move that, you know, move the ball across the finish line to succeed in this, so we can actually restore a very limited federal government, one that will do a great job in maintaining a national security system over us to protect us, because there are a lot of bad actors and real evil people out there. Now, this is why it's important to have constitutional politicians. There's no doubt in my mind, if we've got a politician that is in the presidency and we have, I will just say, constitutional jurists, constitutional members of the Senate and of the House, we will land on our feet and we will rise above this much faster than anybody could believe. Now, it is all about constitutional compliance. As we continue to learn, we learn, pray, and act. And as we act, that acting must be demanding people to abide by and live by the rule of law and in compliance to the Constitution. Those who are under oath and all citizens must be demanding and supporting and defending the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So, as we get and understand what the whole point of Reclaiming the Republic is, demanding that full compliance. That's it. There's nothing to it. We're not an organization. We're just getting everybody else to get to the same frequency and hum and go, so that we are all shaking the earth in getting compliance. It's kind of like that old football game that, you know, kids used to buy, that the field would vibrate, those things would do circles or whatever. That's what we have to do. We have to unite on this very simple principle of full compliance to the Constitution for every person that is a public servant. You're a teacher, you're involved in education, it doesn't matter what you do. If the taxpayers are paying for your privilege to work for the people, then you are obligated to support and defend that Constitution against enemies, foreign and domestic. You're what we would consider the warrior in defending our Constitution. And what we have today is we actually have created the army of insurgency in our public servants. This is why way too many Republicans have joined with the Democrats in waging this insurgency against the Constitution, which is why we see the positions that people are taking from sanctuary cities and so forth. Now, there has been discussions regarding the impeachment of Obama. Well, we have to impeach Clinton, and we have to impeach Bush, and anybody else that's still alive. I think Carter's dead, so that just leaves the three. Clinton, Bush, and Obama. And starting with Obama, that's good. Going backwards. Biden needs to be impeached too, folks. So I don't know why we're not looking at a Biden being impeached, but that needs to happen. All four living presidents, what we want to call living presidents, they're just shills, they need to be impeached. And we'll get into this by going through the Constitution. The word impeachment is brought up 6 times, at least that's what I believe, because I just did a word, you know, a search for MP, and sure enough, it comes up with 6 cases of impeachment, or 6 mentions. So the very first mention is, who has the sole responsibility of the power of impeachment? In other words, who determines whether somebody is to be impeached or not? The House of Representatives. It's right here in Article 1, Section 2. The House of Representatives shall choose their speaker and other officers and shall have the sole power of impeachment. Then the next utilization of the word impeachment comes up in Article 3 in these last subsections. The Senate shall have the sole power to try all impeachments. When sitting for that purpose, they shall be on an oath or affirmation. When the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside, and no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of 2/3 of the members present. In other words, it's not a unanimous decision. It's not a mob rule. It requires 2/3. Now, when it comes to a capital offense, the jury must have a unanimous jury that says this person has to die. And that's in most criminal cases where you have a trial by jury. It also says in the final subsection, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to remove from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. Now that right there, my friends, is the whole kicker, that last part, because everybody, there's no doubt in my mind, everybody's saying, hold on here, these guys aren't presidents. Yes, they're gone. And if they weren't being paid, if they weren't enjoying benefits at the expense of the taxpayers, then they would not be impeachable. But that has changed. Oh, but by the way, the Constitution was never modified. What do I mean by that? When they decided to give permanent emoluments and benefits to former presidents, Congress, the Senate and the House, as well as judges, because they mentioned compensation, that they shall be paid for their time. There's no benefits in the Constitution for retirement. In other words, okay, you served your time, you get continual lifetime pay. You get these benefits and everything else, which means because they do those things, and it's not within the Constitution, their contract of labor is based upon the Constitution. Now, see, the military, they have actually tried to play these games to say, you know what, we're going to give you these privileges and so forth. And now they've created these new rules that say, we can strip you of your retirement and we can incarcerate you and all these things if it comes out that while you're receiving money in your retirement and you speak out against the president, we can come in and take everything from you and throw you in jail. No, they can't. That was never stipulated in the labor agreement that we signed. We signed a labor agreement that we were, see, the whole point is they have the power to raise the military, to maintain the Navy, and so forth. And so when they did this, they created contracts with the individuals to do these things. Those contracts are legitimate constitutional labor agreements. In other words, the Constitution says you can do those labor agreements. And when they created those labor agreements, they're obligated to fulfill those agreements. This is why, folks, I complain all the time. Where's my lifetime, no cost to me, medical and dental? This past year, we've spent thousands and thousands of dollars out of our pocket on medical and dental expenses. You know, I was promised that I would, if I did my 20 years, I wouldn't be in this boat. Now, when it comes to the president, when he walks out of office, all pay stops, everything stops. He's no longer president. He has no control, no voice, none. He's not an influencer. He's a private citizen. But instead, and I like the idea that we've kind of created at least some basic emoluments of security for the former president, because that right there is the one thing that we can strip them of. And the impeachment itself should actually bar them from ever utilizing that title to gain money, because it is right here. And enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States by saying, I'm a former president. So Clinton goes around every year and makes millions of dollars by just standing up and, you know, farting. I don't know what he does, but, this is how these guys have been making money. Now, Bush, on the other hand, Bush doesn't do that. Bush, as I understand it, Bush lives a pretty humble life. The point is, though, that he equally should be tried and impeached for his violations, and he should lose his security. He doesn't deserve Secret Service guarding him at the people's expense because of the things he did in office. He can be impeached and should be impeached. So, as we move forward, I'm just here to tell you folks that there's four presidents that need to be impeached, and Congress needs to take in, and with the truth, or if this is true, if this is really happening, that we're going to finally see Obama impeached, yay. It's about time. It's past time. Anyway, let me get back to the next mention of impeachment. You'll find the next mention of impeachment in, of course, Section 2. And in this subsection, it says, and so let me see here. The president shall be the commander-in-chief of the Army, Navy of the United States, and the militia of the several states when called upon in actual service in the United States. He may require the opinion in writing of the principal officers in each of the executive departments upon any subject relating to the duties of their respective offices. And he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So in other words, once somebody's been impeached, you cannot override the will of the Senate, or the jury. Because when you really look at the impeachment process, the Senate being representatives of the state, meaning the states are actually, their representatives are the jury. It's an equal voice in getting rid or basically impeaching that president. And so the next time it comes up is in Section 4. The President, the Vice President, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and the conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So in other words, once he's impeached or if he's been tried and he has basically had these convictions of treason, bribery. So that's what it says, shall be removed from office on the impeachment for and conviction of. So the next step, the next point that is brought up, and this is the final point, the trial of all crimes except in the case of impeachment shall be by jury. Now, remember we talk about, you know, going through the debates and so forth, and we're just covering this last week in North Carolina, where they were talking about this trial by jury. Well, the trial of all crimes, it doesn't matter, theft, horse theft, whatever, because back in those days, you could hang a man for stealing a horse, right? You could kill somebody for, you know, actually, if you walk in on your spouse and they're in the act of committing adultery, you can kill both your spouse and who they're committing that act with without being tried. I mean, it's just considered, you know, a crime of passion. Anyway, so in looking at the concept of a trial by jury, this is one of the most important things we need to understand that the framers looked at as sacred. They wanted to make sure that the people, the voice of the people, could challenge laws that may have been in pursuance or not in pursuance to the Constitution. Not the Constitution itself. The people cannot impeach or nullify the Constitution, the words of the Constitution and those very specific objects and so forth. But they can, when a law has been created, supposedly implied by an object or not, it doesn't matter, but that law may be actually viewed as immoral, or that law may be viewed as impartial or unfair. I'll give you a good case in point. When we look at our criminal system, the process of determining the bail and or, you know, the fines for committing a crime, and let's just use drunk driving as a good example, there is usually a set rate for, you know, if you are committed, you're found guilty of drunk driving, there's a, you know, a certain amount of time that you have to pay, and or dollars. And many times, or just going in, let's look at the bail first. Going in, the bail is usually preset at maybe $100,000, $150,000, $200,000, whatever it is. Well, for average Joe that makes less than $60,000 an hour, that is like a massive, devastating blow to the baseball star, to these opulent, rich people. That's nothing. They just write the check and they walk out. That is an unjust system. When we look at bail, bail should never be a fixed number. Bail should be a fixed level of pain. In other words, every person that is being tried, the bail should be a fixed 1 month's pay, 1 month's value, you know, a 1/12th of your yearly salary. You know, or you know, and it needs to be equated so that there are folks that don't make any money because they play those games. And I believe that those people that play those games because they show they make no money, then they should be not remanded, but they should actually be held. Is it remanded? Yeah, it should be remanded, I think. No, held without bail. The whole point is, if you want to play that game, where you want to shelter yourself because you're not paying taxes, and this is all because of income tax. I mean, people have created this mirage of, you know, how they protect themselves because the politicians have allowed these things. So any person that actually gets charged and is standing in front of a court and they say, well, I don't make any money. Well, that means that, okay, you're going to be held in jail until your trial's over, period. You don't get any bail. Everybody else actually has a reported income. You want to play that, then I don't have any feelings for you. We have to have a fair system that actually gives everybody the equal level of pain. When we look at, you know, a person being tried for a crime, their paradigm was, it is far better for a guilty man to go free than it is for an innocent man to go to jail. Jail should not be Club Med, and it really isn't, based on circumstantial evidence. When you're providing facts about, you know, the case and what happened and so forth, circumstantial is not actually proving anything directly that this person actually committed the crime. And as a matter of fact, in certain crimes, they want to make sure that the threshold is really hard to get a conviction over any type, especially like murder, circumstantial evidence. But the way the legal system, so that they can get wins, and this is why in a lot of ways we have overcrowding, is because they're allowing circumstantial evidence to be the threshold necessary to actually get a conviction. Let's go back again to the principle that is far worse for an innocent man to go to jail than it is for a guilty man to go free. In other words, we're better off you know, creating a system, but we can't create a system that violates the rights of people. We got to look at, you know, I understand there's a lot of really bad people out there, and some of them are very good at what they do. We have to make sure that we maintain, you know, when we actually, because this is a really tough nut, and I'm not the smartest guy in the world, but I do know that we need to be able to preserve the individual rights. And we actually have a way of doing that regarding the monitoring and so forth of a person. If you've become a suspect, and if you are a, you know, what they call a person of interest, and they have, excuse me, they have what they call probable cause. I honestly believe that that right there in monitoring and that type of thing, when you're finally at that point where a judge goes, okay, this person, but there needs to be a way to keep the judge from overly protecting bad people, because that's what we have today. We have judges, prosecutors, and so forth that are trying to actually create a level of fear in your community because they're not putting bad people away. So, again, this is a tough nut to crack. I'm just saying that this is something that we need to do as a society. We have a responsibility to literally try to solve these difficult problems, these difficult matters, these difficult issues. So, in moving forward, one of the things that I think is really, really important is getting the right people and doing this at the local level. And actually, when you look at the hybrid constitutional republic, there are going to be, what, how many? 4,000, less than 4,000 petri dishes. In other words, test tubes. In other words, test societies where people will be able to, you know, work and work and work and look at what everybody else does and goes, you know what? That is brilliant. Those people really came down with a good idea of how to manage the bail, how to manage these processes. By doing that and empowering the people at the local level, this trial by jury, because I went down this rat hole on the premise that the trial by jury is to actually push the law in the right direction. It is evident that we have lots of biases from racial, from, you know, societal. There's lots of different biases that are driving us. Ideological biases. Folks, one of the things we'll have to do, then I mentioned this this year, and I've mentioned this several times, that ideologically, we're going to have to get to a point where those people who want statist government will not be able to stay here. Because we can't permit that. We can't permit people constantly working activists. I mean, it's one thing to think that that's, you know, I think we'd be better off with that. But those people who are out actively working and trying to subvert our system, once we become enlightened and are able to realize what these folks are doing and the damage that they're doing, then I'm here to tell you folks that we will have what I would say as the, help me out here, we will have the ability to overcome these types of challenges, that we'll actually be able to, you know, go through this mess and come out with far better solutions and actually getting these people out. I believe that reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree. So the only people that we're not going to be able to reach are really the unreasonable people. Because I believe if somebody is reasonable and they may disagree, they won't disagree adamantly. They won't try to undermine you because they're reasonable. When I say most people are reasonable and reasonable people equally informed seldom disagree, what does that mean? I'd probably say over 80% of the population are reasonable people. Therefore, as we look at this, you know, this issue, these issues that we're confronted with, I believe when we actually put all the facts at the table, this is This is why we need to actually start having very difficult conversations. I've been seeking difficult conversations with patriot groups regarding what are the documents that we're going to agree upon in, you know, making constitutional axioms, or what are the documents that truly describe what those clauses in the Constitution mean. For years and years, organizations, the law society, the bar association, so forth, they have been telling us the Federalist Papers are that guide. I've been challenging that. And over the past year, I've proven how the Federalist Papers are the poisonous pill. They deliberately undermine the rule of law and our Constitution, allowing the court to undermine it directly. So, as we look and as we move forward, I'm just excited to be able to say we're going to usher in conversations that will open doors and windows in our society to heaven, where enlightenment, and I'm not talking about a faith or anything like that, but where enlightenment becomes the prevailing pursuit of our society, where we want to get to the facts, and we want to rid our society of these things that are killing us, are these addictions, these things that drag us down and are actually taking life. We don't want to see people die, but we can't take the choice of an individual from them. Because these people are so far gone, sometimes they're that far gone, folks. If we can save them, and I don't fault anybody for trying, but not at everyone's expense. I believe this is where having these difficult conversations will actually bear the fruit of saying, you know what, you're absolutely right. If you've got a drug addict that is, you know, in and out of therapy and so forth, and they've got this long history, three strikes, whatever you want to create, to finally create the threshold to say, once you go beyond this third strike, we will not help you. If you're sitting, you're injured, and you're all drugged and what have you, we're not going to give you medical aid. It doesn't matter. You have to know that you're taking a course that will kill you, and we're not going to try to stop you from being self-destructive. But if something happens to you, we're not going to help you anymore. We have to give people the reason to change, as long as they know they have an infinite safety net. They will keep going back and forth, vacillating, and maybe something changes. But it's a very rare condition. It's the same thing as capital punishment. I honestly believe that capital punishment really should come back. I believe when people take another life, when people have done such harm to others, that it's irreparable, then I truly believe that, you know, we need to basically say, you know, not three strikes, this type of thing. You commit this crime, that's it. It makes people think twice about going down that path, because a life in prison is nothing. Anyway, at least that's how too many people look at it that way. Anyway, sorry for the rat hole. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.